Hello, everyone. This is Dr. Cheryl Selman, and thank you so much for joining me today on What Women Must Know. This is a show dedicated to empowering you with truthful information so you can make the most aware and wise decisions in your life. And as always, this is such a wonderful opportunity to have some great conversations. I know this show is always a great opportunity for me to learn and grow, and I'm sure it is for all of my listeners as well. For those of you who are visiting this show for the first time, please go over to my website and visit whatwomenmustknow.com. I have some special reports I give out, and all my radio shows get sent out to you once you opt into my newsletter, so it's a great place to stay educated. And also, my Facebook page, which is What Women Must Know, is a place where I post on a daily basis some great information, great articles, the kinds of information that really makes a difference in our lives. So feel free to like me over there. And we have an amazing show today, all the way from Mumbai. My guest is calling in. I was listening to an NPR radio interview, and I'm driving down the road, and I tuned into a most fascinating conversation on the TED show on NPR, and it was so fascinating. I actually had to follow up this guest and find out what he was all about, who he was, and then the next thing, I was contacting him. So we have an amazing show arranged for you today. We're going to be exploring how our beliefs create our world with Devdutt Patnaik, and he is calling us from Mumbai, India, live on the line. And let me just share a little bit about who he is. He is a renowned author, mythologist, and leadership consultant whose work focuses on deriving management insights from mythology to reveal a very Indian approach to modern businesses. He has authored over 30 books, trained in medicine. Devdutt spent 15 years in the healthcare industry with companies such as Apollo Health Street and Sanofi Aventis before joining Ernst & Young as business advisor. All this while, he continued to study and write on mythological stories and symbols, drawing rich insights about business, leadership, and modern life. His TED Talk is one of the most viewed talks with over a million views. And he was the chief belief officer of Future Group and is now a sought-after public speaker and culture consultant for corporations and business leaders. He was born and educated in Mumbai, and he now presently lives in Mumbai. So it's my great pleasure to welcome you to the show today, Devdutt. Thank you so much.
Thank you. Thank you for calling me.
I'm sure your TED Talk has opened up lots of doors for you.
It has. It has. Lots of people get familiar with my work because of TED.
And, you know, I found your talk so compelling because I love to explore mythologies. Mythologies in whatever culture they're found hold deep and profound spiritual, philosophical truths, and they are really meant to convey and educate us on another non-intellectual level, really. You're communicating from a different place of our consciousness, or so I believe. You know, I first encountered Joseph Campbell, who is, you know, is that great researcher, mythologist, when I did you ever see his wonderful television series on the hero's journey?
Yes, I have. It's on the internet, and I have watched it. Years ago.
It was years ago, and I was absolutely mesmerized by that series and this whole concept of understanding our deeper truths through mythology. And I know that's what you're very dedicated to right now.
Yes, I am.
Go ahead. Go ahead.
No, I just that now the meanings which Joseph Campbell wrote when he spoke about it was a long time ago, and since then our understanding of the world has changed a lot. Our understanding of literature and the way we approach studies has all changed, and therefore the language and vocabulary has. We have got far better vocabulary today to understand these things.
So what is your passion with mythology? Why have you you've created yourself, and as we were sharing before we started this interview, your work is about mythologies and understanding how the mythologies and how cultures are created out of those mythologies and express those mythologies, which we'll talk about, which is fascinating. But I find your life really fascinating because you started as a medical doctor, then you went into working with the pharmaceutical industry on the corporate side, but this passion arose within you to follow mythologies, and like you said in your bio, you didn't study it anywhere, so you had to create that position, which now has gotten you into some very profound positions, and as we said, you're a sought-after speaker. So you, in a sense, have created your life out of your passions and visions.
You know, when you say it like this, it sounds so dramatic, but it was really a very simple thing because I was working in a pharmaceutical company. It was a proper job. I was in marketing, sales, training. And in my spare time, I would just sort of explore Indian mythology and read books on mythology. It was something like a hobby, which you do on your weekends and your free time. But as the years progressed, I realized all the problems that I faced in office, all the interpersonal issues that I saw around me, I found solutions to it and answers to it in the stories I was reading. And when I started reading on management, because I'm not an MBA, and therefore I had to study a lot to understand what these words meant, like strategy and tactics and all business planning. So I had to read up a lot. And the more I read it, I understood that there were some assumptions in modern management. And I wondered where these assumptions came from. And when I started realizing, I realized that they came from Greek myths and from Abrahamic myths and from Indian myths. And I realized myths really were shaping us in unconscious ways. We were just not aware of it. We assumed what we were saying is rational and logical, but they're not. You know, just remove the veneer and you'll realize there are structures here which have been existing in human civilization as long as humans have been around, and it's only located differently in these wonderful stories, symbols, rituals. And since we don't know or we don't pay attention to them, we don't realize these structures have always existed in some form or the other out there. We are just not aware of it. And I just became aware of it. I got excited about it, and I started talking about it, and people liked what I had to say. And one thing led to another, and I had a career out of it.
So can you elaborate a bit more on these themes? And I know this is what you talked about in your TED Talk, and I think they're really important. The understanding the myths and the myths that in our Western culture we live by that determine how we perceive reality and therefore how we structure our lives, and then also the myths out of India and how that created another construct of reality and culture.
So let's take a look at, for example, if you look at Greek myths. A Greek myth, the oldest Greek myths are the Iliad and the Odyssey, and both of them are heroic narratives. And they are talking about heroes on journeys who are trying to do something extraordinary in their life, and they're trying to reach, they're facing a lot of obstacles, and the obstacles are being created by the gods. And the solutions are also being offered by another set of gods, and they're all coming from Olympus. So some gods like them, some gods support them, some gods block them, and they're struggling to go through life and achieve their objective. So you have Achilles in Iliad, and you have Odysseus in the Odyssey, the Homeric epics. And it's always about going somewhere. There's this destination you want, or an achievement that you want to achieve. You want to go somewhere, and it's always about breaking a boundary. And that's what you see typically in Greek myths. When you contrast it with when you read the Bible, you read a very different kind of storytelling. You find a storytelling where people are not talking about achievements, people are not talking about breaking boundaries, and the gods are not creating trouble. You find the notion of the promised land and of following the prophet who will take you to this wonderful place called the promised land, the land of milk and honey. So if the Greek myths talk about the powerful authority as the as the cruel father, the biblical traditions and the Abrahamic mythology talks of authority as a kind and caring father. And you find these two structures in Western, which are completely opposite to each other in Western myths. But when you come to India, you find a very different structure. There is no concept of a cruel father or a caring father. You find a concept where father can be sometimes kind and sometimes cruel. And the structures change because there's no concept of achievement, there's no concept of promised land. And you keep wondering, why is it not there in these stories? There's no concept of prophet, there's no concept of the Elysian field, there's no concept of heaven and hell as we know it. There's no one in heaven and hell, there are multiple heavens and hell. And you realize that in the Indian subcontinent, you have the notion of rebirth. You don't live once, you live many lives. And that's a different structure. And suddenly when you look at the stories of the world, you realize that stories are telling you different ways of looking at the world, different assumptions about life. In Greek myths, you live only once and you better do something extraordinary. You have to achieve something extraordinary to have a good life. And if you read the Abrahamic myths, it talks about believing that there's a caring father out there and listening to the words of the prophet and finding alignment through obedience and love. And in the Indian traditions, it is you suddenly find the concept of rebirth, where this is okay, that is also okay. The point is not achievement, the point is not going somewhere, the point is discovering what's going on. That's a very different structure. So these are some of the structures that I found in storytelling. And I realized that, you know, that's what creates cultural diversity. That is why people are so different in this world. There are achievement-driven people. There are obedience-driven people. There are people who want to understand and not achieve. All kinds of people in the world, because there are all kinds of stories in this world.
And it's so fascinating because every culture, wherever you are in the world, has created myths. You can go into the Amazon and they have their myths. You can go into the Aboriginal culture in Australia. They have very profound myths that determine their perception of reality, which, of course, has always created a lot of problem in Australia, where I spend a lot of time, because their perception of reality is, I would say, diametrically opposed to the Western concept of reality.
In fact, you know, the problem is unfortunately with the word myths, because it has a colonial hangover where myths are associated with falsehood. So, you know, it's either true or false in a binary world. But more and more people have realized that, you know, these are subjective truths. You know, we have to define myths clearly. These are subjective truths, my truth and your truth. And the tribe, every tribe has its own truth, and they express it through stories, symbols, rituals, songs, and dance. Those are modes of expression. And when you start appreciating it as language, we realize that different tribes, different communities, different groups of people have seen the world very differently. And you see, as human beings, if you talk to an evolutionary psychologist, he will say that human beings need stories to anchor themselves. Animals don't need that story. Our brain has evolved, we have imagination, and we are constantly seeking meaning, purpose, value. And since we don't get a manual when we are born, we seek it outside us, and stories provide us that meaning, purpose. What are we supposed to do with our lives? And no scientist on earth can answer this question. What's the purpose of life? For that, you need a philosopher. You need a poet. You need a mythologist. You need a myth maker, a shaman, who will tell you this is how the world is designed, this is the architecture of the world, and this is how you're supposed to live your life. Take away the poets, take away the mythologists, take away the shamans, storytellers. Life will have no structure. And that's something that people just don't realize. Are all our assumptions about this is life's purpose, they're just stories. There is no scientific way of proving it exists.
This reminds me of an episode. I don't know if it was a wonderful series on American television called Northern Exposure. Have you ever heard of that series?
Vaguely, yes.
Northern Exposure. It took place in a little town up supposedly in Alaska, and all these characters live together. And the episode that comes to mind as you're talking about this is the medicine man, the Indian medicine man, comes into the town, into the bar where everyone gathers, and he asks different people, tell me your stories. Tell me your stories. Tell me your myths. You know, and he talks about all the myths of the from the Indian tradition that are teaching myths, teaching stories, teach those values. And you know, all the things. The only thing that the Americans come up with are like Santa Claus. You know, all these really rather meaningless and insipid stories, no depth to great deeper spiritual truths. And it was a very poignant episode. In that show, which is, I think, what we're talking about here, the importance of mythologies to help guide and give our spirits a deeper understanding of who we are and why we are here, which is probably why our Western culture is in such a crisis and why we buy so many things, because we're searching for a deeper meaning, but our cultural construct didn't really come with those directions for us.
You see, what happened, I feel, in the Western societies is this great rupture between the state and the church. And, it has widespread repercussions because when you ask this fundamental question, where does a society get meaning from? How do you make yourself meaningful? The church came up with the idea of God and prophet and church, and the state does not offer an equivalent. It says, I'll provide you food, clothing, shelter. At least that's what my obligation is, but I don't have a story to give meaning. States don't, and therefore the worst form is nationalism, and political ideologies therefore emerge, and therefore all kinds of negative ideologies emerge in the absence of a story, because we find it, we are continuously seeking something which is real. I always tell people, when I look at, if I want to understand America, I have to see the Hollywood films, because that is the only form of storytelling that is legitimate. And their stories are, and through those stories you can see structures happening. You're seeing a whole series of structures emerging. And I'm using this rather crudely because but the storytelling from a Hollywood perspective is very powerful. And it does have a particular structure in mind that continuously plays with that structure. And the notion of, for example, Star Wars, where there's a hero myth being replayed. In fact, Hollywood recreates the hero myth again and again and again. You have films like Apollo 13 or Gravity, which talks about individualism, individual achievement. It celebrates that, this individual, the life of the individual and his glory. In many ways, they sort of resonate Greek mythic structures, not overtly, but it is there, this whole idea of the individual who will survive against the odds and do something extraordinary. And I think that's why we love people like Bill Gates or Warren Buffett, who have come from nowhere and done something extraordinary. So these are our modern versions of Greek heroes. I think there's something dramatic about them and powerful about them, and we sort of celebrate them. Steve Jobs, who changes the world. And there is a teleological narrative that we will change the world. And this notion that I'll make a better world, it comes from the good life of Aristotle, that we will one day create a world where there will be no more problems. This is not a global way of thinking. This is a purely, it was a European way of thinking. It continues to be the European way of thinking. It is also, to some degree, an American way of thinking. But it need not be a Chinese way of thinking. It need not be an Indian way of thinking. We assume these are universal ideas. They're not. They're cultural ideas.
And that creates a clash at times, because whether it's you know, whether you're taking it on an international level, and I do want you to talk a bit about the Indian perspective and how their culture, your culture, has created your, you know, your myths have created your culture, and how people are choosing to find value in their lives out of that Indian perspective. And also, the other interesting thing I wanted to ask you, you know, as a colonial country where you were, you know, under the rule of England for so many years, so many decades, so many centuries, how does that affect modern-day India as well, which seems to have adopted a lot of those values over time? And these are just some thoughts. I'm really fascinated by it, so I'll just let you jump in.
So you see, many of us understand India through the Western lens. You see, Bernard Cohn, a very famous anthropologist, has written this wonderful article of what does colonization do? When colonies were created in India, they wanted to understand India. And therefore, a whole bunch of scholars known as Orientalists or Indologists and historians understood first the language. They made a note of the vocabulary. So they created dictionaries, rules of grammar, and they documented a culture which until then was oral. And the nature of oral stories, the problem with oral stories is that oral stories are fluid. And the moment you document them, they get fixed. And this fixing in the written word is where the problem started, because India is a very vast and diverse country, and you could only document a small portion of it. And because it was a colonial administration which was interested in exploiting the resources of the land, the only thing they documented was that which enabled them to control the people of the land. And therefore, they created the Indian Penal Code, and they gave it a structure. So they structured India in a way that was convenient. And this structure is what we have inherited as our understanding of India, because it is documented. And today, people are realizing that the Indian ethos doesn't come from the documented sources, but from the oral traditions of India. And the oral traditions are extremely powerful, and therefore, there is a clash in India to define what is India. Is it what is documented? And therefore, there is a lot of resentment in India against Indologists in Europe and America. Even today, American Indologists write about India, and they've almost inherited the colonial mantle, and they come with structures that can be sometimes problematic. But it's only now that people have raised their voice and questioning it, both in India and in America, where people are questioning the post-colonial gaze and questioning structures. You see, the fundamental structure is this, if you want to understand India, is that from India comes this very unique worldview, which is based on rebirth. Now, what does it mean? Imagine believe you live only one life. If you live only one life, you want to live it the right way, because it's the only life you have. And therefore, achievement matters. Righteousness matters. Rules, ethics. You want this one and only life to be perfect. There is a destination. There is an end point. However, a culture which for a thousand and thousands of years has believed that this is just one of many lives. So in Buddhism, Hinduism, Jainism, these are the major schools of thought which emerged in India, you believe you have many lives. Now, when you believe you have many lives, there is no full stop. It's a comma. Death is not a full stop. Death is a comma. And therefore, there is no end point. There is no destination. You are just on a journey. You are on a sea. But there is no port of call. Now, that's a very different way of looking at the world. And therefore, life is about a series of experiences that you go through a whole bunch of things, but there is no destination. This is a very different way of looking at the world. And it is something that people grapple with, because you are being told that there is no end point. And then you realize what makes India. So when you come to India you will find the absence of perfection. That is, nobody look. So when you go to an American city, you see a lot of organization. When I come to India, you will see that there is an organization of a very different kind, which the Western mind perceives as chaos, but the Indian mind perceives as negotiated boundaries. So that's a very different way of looking at the world. And we are just not, it's only now that people are talking about diversity and pluralism, and we are appreciating that different people look at the world differently. The Aborigines looked at the world differently. The Native Americans looked at the world differently. They didn't believe the world was problematic and was a problem to be solved. They did not look at nature as chaotic that needed to be domesticated. They did not see life as something where you have to achieve something. They did not believe in full stops and endpoints and destinations. But we never gave that a chance in the colonial and to some degree the post-colonial period. And today we are facing the consequences of it.
That's so interesting. So it's in a sense from that Indian perspective, it's rediscovering who they really are because it's been overshadowed for so many centuries.
Absolutely. I'll give you an example. For example, the word, we have heard of films like Avatar, right?
Yes.
So we see a film like Avatar with James Cameron does, and the word Avatar is almost used like a superhero, and it is almost used like the Iron Man, where you wear a suit and you have a different identity, and that's an avatar in video games, for example. You just change your identity, you wear a mask, you wear a special cloak, and you become special, and you become an avatar. Now, that's a complete reversal of meanings. That is not what an avatar means. It's the very opposite of a hero. A hero or a superhero is an ordinary person who does something extraordinary. It is a superhero is an ordinary human being who gets special powers and becomes larger than what he is and hopefully handles it with responsibility. An avatar is the very opposite. It is someone with extraordinary powers who becomes ordinary for the benefit of humanity. Now, that's a very different, that James Cameron doesn't get it in his film. So when you see the film Avatar, people assume that's the meaning of the word avatar. So when they read Indian books, they're thinking they're reading superhero books. But that's not superheroes. It is talking about a being who has infinite wisdom, who contracts himself and makes himself smaller to deal with human beings. So to give you an example of it is a mother who sort of, when she's playing with her baby, she pretends and talks like a baby. She does baby talk with the baby because the baby doesn't understand anything else. Therefore, you, a larger human being, has become smaller for the sake and benefit of the child. The parent becomes small for the benefit of the child. That is avatar. Now, this concept has not even reached the West. Because when I talk to scholars who do work on Indian, and I say, do you know the meaning of the word avatar? And they come up with the word superhero, and I'm saying, you're missing the point. In many ways, this is my criticism of Joseph Campbell and Carl Jung, because they universalized Greek ideas. The assumption was, what is there in Greek mythology is everywhere. But it's only now in this world where we're appreciating diversity and plurality, we are realizing that that's not true, that the meanings of the words are very different. A hero, there is no concept of hero in Indian mythology. Or rather, there is a concept like that, but it is not the dominant concept. The dominant concept is avatar. And my work tries to help people understand that so that they understand that, you know, the Indian way of seeing and the European way of seeing is different from the American way of seeing. And the more we appreciate different people's ways of seeing, we'll have better relationships. We'll be better people. As you know, we'll be far more empathetic. We'll be far more accommodating. We will not try to impose our views on others. We will try to find solutions rather than trying to dominate and domesticate people who don't agree with us.
And this is the point of why your work and this kind of understanding is so profound, because we see this playing out on so many different levels. We see it on the level of nation states. You know, there's this rivalry between right now the United States and China. We fear China. They see us as a threat. But really, if we could embrace a perception where we learn about each other's cultures and needs and how each culture perceives what the values are. We could have a dialogue. We could create much more harmony and support for each other by honoring our different perceptions of reality. We don't have to accept the other person's cultural beliefs, but we can accept them as true for them and try to find a way to meet in the middle somehow. Is that
Pollyanna?
I
completely agree. You know, at one level, I think we need to outgrow this need for the truth with a capital T. This very monotheistic view of things. What I mean by that is that there is the truth out there, and who knows the truth? And that's where the quarrels start, because everybody claims they know the truth and they are right. But if you just accept that nobody really knows the truth, we all have a fractured view of reality, we all have a prejudiced view of reality, then there'll be humility, and I will allow you. There will be room for negotiation. There will be room for listening and learning from others. It's because our worldviews are not static. Our belief systems are not fixed and rigid. They continuously evolve. Like as human beings, our views of the world change. If I were to ask you, are your belief systems today the same thing as they were 10 years ago? In all likelihood, you will say no, because your experiences have changed and your interactions with the world have transformed you. And you know that you are not the same person you were 10 years ago. In the same way, it's because you've allowed yourself for new ideas to come in and impact you. And I think that is what is missing in the world. Rather than trying to prove that what we know already is the truth, and seeking endorsement of our view, I think we should expand our mind to new ideas, listen. And I think in a relationship, that's what works, right? If a husband and wife, or a boyfriend and girlfriend, or a boyfriend, girlfriend, any relationship in the world, you have to listen to the other person, allow their views to percolate into yours. And only then you can have a relationship. Otherwise, it will be a tug of war. And in a tug of war, only one person will win and somebody will get hurt. And I think that's what's going on in the world, in the debates on television, in political arenas, in the parliaments, in the senates. You're seeing tug of war going on.
Yeah.
It's not conversation, you know. No. There is no churning. Churning is not tug of war. In churning, you sort of let go when the other is pulling. And when there's a time when you pull and there's a time when you let go. You allow people to sort of have their say. But I think currently we are in an era of tug of war. Everybody wants to win and be right and claim their truth as the truth. And I think that's a space of violence.
Well, that's something that's gone on for eons of time, hasn't it? It's like, you know, as we, as humanity, are trying to wake up and evolve, we need to learn how to listen and honor and respect each other. There's a wonderful teacher of mine, Dr. Harville Hendrix, who focuses on relationships, and he has some very simple exercises that he does to help couples heal and hopefully be able to sustain their relationships. And one of those exercises is he has these couples sitting across from each other, and one person says something, whatever. And the other person has to just mirror it back to them. And then they receive the communication if that what was mirrored back was what that person said. And if not, they need to repeat it again in a way so the person who said it feels that they are understood. Now, the person who's mirroring it back does not have to agree with that statement. They just have to be in deep listening mode where that person who is communicating feels they are heard. And this simple listening exercise, because he goes all the way back to childhood, he goes, we were never validated, we were never listened to, we were told how it is, we were told who we're supposed to be, and we bring that into our relationships, we bring that into our workplace, we bring that model out into the world of, you know, not people never feel heard, and so we try to push harder to be heard and understood and loved. And he goes back to those very simple exercises, just listening, making making sure you're heard, validated, it's repeated back, so you get that you're heard. And as we're having this conversation, it just reminds me of what we need to do to feel really loved, which is probably at the basis of why we're trying to make our way right, so we could feel we're okay.
Yes. You see, what happens is in our desire to be validated, we sometimes forget that we need to validate others too. So while we need to speak, we also need to listen. And I think this two-way process is somewhere forgotten. Or it is always quid pro quo. It's almost like a trade. I have heard you, now you hear me.
Mm-hmm. But we're closed. We're not really listening. We're just...
Yes, we are not listening, because then it's like a trade. We are trading with each other. And
yeah.
I have heard you for 5 minutes, now you hear me for 5 minutes. Or you're spoken for 10 minutes, so I'll speak for 10 minutes. Now, that's not the point. The point is to genuinely see the other and understand. I see, you know, we forget sometimes that all living creatures are bundles of fear. We are all terrified. The fact is, we are all seeking in Indian scriptures, there's a concept of purushartha, which is validation of human existence. Every human being is seeking a validation of his life. And so we look at things around us, we look at our skills, we look at our property and our wealth and our achievements, and these are all means to validate ourselves. But that's not enough, because we want the others to acknowledge us. We yearn for the other to say that we are good. And the thing is, in yearning, we forget that others are yearning from us too. It's a two-way process. What we have control is giving validation. We do not have control on receiving validation. And because I cannot control the other and I demand that he validate me, but what I can control is I can validate others. I can be present for them. I can make them feel they are being seen, heard, acknowledged. And I can ask them that if I have an intimate relationship with them, that they do the same for me. And I think that's intimacy. That's when you become intimate, when you talk to someone and say that, you know, you are not there for me, you're not listening to me, and to reach that level. But in the first stage, it's only that you can give. Only when you give can you expect to get. There are no guarantees, but you hope you will get.
So what is your advice to people who are, feeling that they are frustrated in their lives, feeling that something is missing, feeling that the values of, at least in our Western culture, are not fulfilling deeper needs or deeper truths? And what do you offer people? What are your words of wisdom to them from your teachings as a mythologist? What would you suggest?
You know, I always tell people that we have to appreciate the difference between, and this is of course a very crude statement, but between animals and humans. Animal functions in order to, survival is what it seeks. It seeks food and it seeks security. Humans are not just satisfied with food and security. We are also seeking meaning. And what I tell people is that can you create meaning for others? See how they give themselves meaning and sort of mirror it back to them. And hopefully they will do the same to you eventually. But begin by giving. Don't really expect. And in fact, the more you observe people, you realize how difficult it is for people to reciprocate. And therefore that sort of, in a way, helps you understand the human condition. And you don't expect too much, but you become more and more generous. And then if you're lucky, you are at the receiving end of generosity. And I think that's being really, that's really wonderful to have, but there are no guarantees in life that it will happen. What is guaranteed is you can become generous. You can discover that there is a lot of love inside you and that you can give without expecting to receive. And I think that discovery makes us autonomous and powerful.
Yeah, so fascinating. There's such a huge movement in the United States with an interest in meditation and Buddhism. The other trend that's happening in the United States that comes out of the shaman from South America are working with the plant medicines like ayahuasca, which are, I mean, all these are different ways to facilitate a deeper, more profound connection to the meaning of life and to who we are and how we can be living our life in a more meaningful, satisfying, and connected way. Are you aware of those trends that are happening?
Yes, I am. My only worry with many of these trends is that they focus too much on the self and they focus very little on the other. You see, what happens is we live in an ecosystem of others. We don't live in isolation. We live in relationships. Many of these practices focus on the self to such an extent that they isolate you from the rest of the world. My practice has always been about telling people to achieve self-realization through other realization. By noticing the vulnerabilities and inadequacies and the yearnings of the other, you appreciate your own vulnerabilities, your own inadequacies, and your own vulnerabilities. And I think that two-way process is something that I am very insistent on, because this, somewhere along the line, I think Maslow is to blame, one might say, because he speaks of self-actualization. And it's all about the self. There is no other in it. The other doesn't exist. It's very Greek hero's lonely journey, like Odysseus, you know, going home all alone without his crewman. And I think that loneliness of life, without realizing the empathy for the loneliness of those around us, and I think that the understanding of those around us is absolutely critical. I think that's the only slight modification I make in all these practices. Is, you know, in India there's this concept that in Buddhism, he's the hermit who walks away from his family and shuts his eyes when he sits in the monastery. When life is about stepping out of the monastery, opening your eyes and returning to your family, being the householder. So this yearning to be the hermit, which is an individual, my journey, and the householder, where it is a relationship driven, I think the balance between these two is very critical. And I think that is something that the world is yearning for. It cannot be a lonely journey into my own self, but my journey into the selves of others.
And here's the paradox, because when you live in a culture where you've been conditioned to just go out and grab whatever you can for yourself, you disregard the other. When you can practice through practice such as meditation, where you learn compassion for yourself, which leads you to have compassion for others, or if you work with plant medicines, which also give you a direct experience of yourself, your limitations, your hopefully opening you to a greater connection to life. I think that's what's compelling people to do this search, because it is desiring to connect, but those connections have to start within ourselves first, and we have to place some time to making that connection with our inner self to open our hearts, to focus on compassion, which then goes out into the world.
Yes, and I think the first step to that is to acknowledge the fears that you and I have. It's to see the fears of people. What makes a person snobbish? What makes a person have attitude? What makes a person be rude and obnoxious? These are all defense mechanisms to handle our loneliness. You know, the desire to dominate, the desire to be territorial, the desire to form packs, the desire to behave like a herd, the desire to be a queen bee, all these are coming from an essential loneliness and a yearning for validation. And I think when we see that in the world around us, I think compassion follows. So I think observation of people's fears makes us compassionate. I think where does compassion come from? It comes from observing how frightened the world is. So if you read the early Buddhist scriptures, they speak a lot of wisdom, and the later Buddhist pictures speak of compassion, because wisdom makes you see people's vulnerabilities, and the only emotion that will emerge after that is compassion. So it's a consequence. You see, you recognize, understand, and it evokes compassion within you. So you don't have to train yourself to be compassionate. You become compassionate when you understand and see the world for what it is.
Yeah, that's so true. And that's a journey that is part of this awakening that's happening, I think, all over the world, actually, as we get crazier with our, the acquisition of wealth, as there is just more emphasis on things and how the world is evolving. We're searching for a way to gain and regain the wisdom and the compassion. People are dissatisfied. People are frustrated. People feel lonely and empty. There's something driving us to learn a deeper truth.
Yes, I think talk back. I prefer a dog because a dog will not talk back to me. The day the dog starts talking back to me, I will not like him as a pet. Or a thing which will not go away. I bring it home, it will stay with me as long as I want it, and when I don't want it, I can throw it away in the garbage. But humans can't be like that. They will come and go at their own pace, they'll talk back, and therefore relationships are far more complicated, and it terrifies us because they continuously invalidate us. And the point is not to expect, but to provide. And I think when that switch takes place, where I am no longer the receiver, but the provider, what I would like to receive, yes, but I make myself strong so that I don't need to receive, but when I receive, I'm overwhelmed and joyful about it. But I am preparing myself to be a greater provider, and it is, you find this abundant space within you because you don't feel depleted when you provide, because you're not doing it out of expectation. And I think that's it. Otherwise, if you do it out of expectation, one day you'll find yourself being depleted and feeling exploited in a relationship. And I think this is in India, these ideas are explained through rituals. And the thing is, even Indians have not seen it. When I talk to my friends and show them the rituals, they're like, oh, we never saw it like that. I said, because nobody explained it like that. Because the rituals are all about exchange, giving and receiving, not giving and taking, not a contractual agreement, but an exchange where you give and hope to receive. And that's the fundamental Indian model of human relationships. You give and you hope to receive. You hope to evoke humanity in the other. And that's a process, because the only thing in your control is the giving, not, and what is you receive is really not in your control. You want to control it, but you can't.
Hmm. Do you think that in India you've become very well known? You've written 30 books, and I mean, I've checked you out, and you're on television shows, and you're written up in newspapers and magazines. You have quite a presence in India. Do you think it's because you're an emerging voice to help Indians connect back to those primary values of the culture that have been, in a sense, lost?
Yes. I think for various reasons. One is Indians have been very defensive and apologetic about Hinduism and the mythologies of India. There has been this, I'm educated and therefore I want to distance myself from anything which is remotely seen as religious. And I have these stories which are really childish. I don't want to be associated with them. I'm secular, I'm liberal, and therefore I shall not be associated with anything mythic. There is this huge shame and guilt associated with tradition amongst educated Indians. I have not gone that path. I have neither been defensive nor have been apologetic. I have, like a scientist, just broken it down and tried to understand what are they trying to say. That's one part. The second part is I have not felt the need to follow the colonial framework. I have sort of stepped back and re-looked at it in a different way, and it has revealed answers which were not known before. So these two things, not being apologetic, not being and defensive on one side, so it's an emotional thing, and the other is the intellectual, the rigor, the academic rigor which I brought in, which I did not sort of depend on colonial frameworks to explain it. And I sort of challenge the colonial frameworks and say that, well, that's not the only way, and there are other ways of looking at the same rituals and stories. I think these two things worked in my favor, and have got me a lot of attention because people had never seen these stories being told in this way. I also, you know, I always tell people, you cannot understand India without understanding the world. Just as I said, you cannot understand yourself without understanding the other. In order to understand India, you have to understand the West, you have to understand China. You have to see how different, why are you not Chinese? Why are you not European and American? And that will enable you to understand yourself without chauvinism, without being nationalistic, without being arrogant and cultural pride, which is one of the diseases we see in society today. And I think these are the things that the approach and the language that has made a difference. I think somewhere people, it has sort of connected with people, and I'm glad, you know, I gave, and by various ways, I think I'm receiving now.
That's so wonderful. You know, I lived in India for 2 years, way back in the, gosh, in the 1980s. And so I haven't been back since. I loved India. I lived in South India. My experience of India was that you either, as a Westerner, you either love it or you hate it because it's so different. And you can either embrace it and experience the uniqueness of that culture, or you're overlaying it with your own values and are just, you know, horrified or judgmental at how it is. But I felt very much at home in India. I loved India. And, it, you know, since I haven't been back in all these decades, and when I see pictures of what's happening in India and stories, I was quite concerned because I felt that the Western, adopting so much of the Western culture in India would possibly destroy that powerful and profound spiritual essence that is India, you know. And so I'm, you know, it's reassuring to hear what you're saying, to know that there's an emergence of within India of their precious inner resources and wisdoms that they have had for so long.
You see, India has always had ideas coming from other parts of the world, contrary to, you know, right-wing opinions. India has had Alexander, in the wake of Alexander, a whole bunch of Indo-Greeks came to India, Persian ideas came to India, Central Asian ideas have come to India, Chinese ideas have come to India, colonial ideas, the Islamic ideas have come into India, and they've all nourished India because the way the Indian, it's like a quilt. You take ideas and you stitch it together, and the quilt keeps building over time. So even a Western idea doesn't overwhelm India. It will look like a thread, but it eventually will be digested and be made part of this quilt.
Yeah.
And that is something that people don't recognize. It is this innate. So therefore, even today, things which were practiced 2,000 years ago can still be seen in India today. Things which were practiced 1,000 years ago, which only emerged 1,000 years ago, are still being practiced in India today. So everything survives and everything changes at the same time. It doesn't wipe the slate clean, unlike many other cultures. When a new regime comes, the old is wiped out. You don't see that in India. So even when the Muslims came to India, they participated in the pre-Islamic culture. And therefore, the Islam in India is extremely different from the Islam that you would see in, for example, the Middle East. And it is in this new political ecosystem that is emerging that we are creating these boundaries where this is Hindu and that is Muslim, which really didn't exist, and it still doesn't exist on a day-to-day level if you live in India. But now that this politics of division is spreading around the world, you know, the whole idea of nation-state with the notion of boundaries and visa rules that sort of separates me and you, you know, is being challenged in a way by the internet, right? The internet and the telephone, the fact that I can just pick up the phone and talk to you is a challenge to the system that I can't really visit you unless I have a visa. So my physical movement may be restricted by some political rules that I can't talk to you face to face. But there is an electronic and there is a new world of the virtual reality emerging, which is breaking these boundaries and saying that, you know, pick up the phone and talk to people in America and just pick up and go on the internet and chat at the same time or play video games together. And I think this is the new challenge that is emerging to these divisive forces. So there's a glue emerging along with the axe.
You know, it is pretty amazing that India, with its immense diversity, how many languages are there in India?
Well, officially 28.
And unofficially?
Over 600.
So let's go with the unofficial. So with 600 different cultures and languages, it's really phenomenal that India has remained stitched together for as long as it has and is functioning as well as it has. You know, and I mean, that says a lot that cultures are living and coexisting together and hopefully learning and sharing with each other.
You know, in Africa, there were different tribes which coexisted in different ways. They quarreled with each other. They fought with each other. There were tribes. And suddenly somebody came and imposed nation states and separated tribal lands. And they assumed the nation state is going to create a new order. But the tribal divisions still exist. And the tribal way of functioning still exists. You know, modernity brought in nation states. It didn't exist 100 years ago. There were empires 100 years ago. And until we assumed that the nation state is going to bring peace and prosperity, this didn't. It is leading us to different kinds of war.
Yeah.
So I guess...
Oh, go ahead. No, go ahead.
No, I guess things, you know, things come and go. These ideas come and go. And communities will always be there. And they will fight with each other. They will sort of figure out ways of living with each other. We had no choice.
Yeah. You know, I saw a fantastic documentary about the history of India over thousands of years. And, you know, when there were warriors from different cultures, whether it's Islam invaded, so maybe it's Akbar, some of the great leaders, I can't remember all their names,
yes,
but these,
yes,
these
Akbar,
they
yes.
came in, I mean, they were warriors, they were vicious, I mean, they, you know, had to conquer. But when they landed in India and set up their realms, their transformations happened to many of these leaders, spiritual transformations. And then they changed and they created cultures that were inclusive. And there were golden ages in India where all these different religions and cultures came together and created immense abundance for everyone and culture and arts. And that was a fascinating bit of Indian history that must still exist within your psyche at some point.
Yes, it's always there. So you see, you're right now going through a phase where you see a little bit more of polarization, but everybody knows that the counter movement has also started. Because the more polarization there is, there's a more desire to see the other kindly. So there's always a force and a counterforce, and people don't realize that. There's always a force and a counterforce. Sometimes one, you know, sometimes there's salt and sometimes there's pepper. Sometimes there's too much of pepper and sometimes there's too much of salt. and this game goes on forever. This is Indian philosophy, that nothing lasts forever. And Western philosophy doesn't have that. So the assumption is the world is going... So there are films in Hollywood like Apocalypse and 2015 where the world is going to come to an end. But since Indians believe in rebirth, you know that nothing comes to an end. The golden ages will always come back. They have to.
And that concept of all these fear-based apocalyptic movies and stories really go deep into the psyche of Westerners. There's quite a terror right now of the world coming to an end, you know, global warming and wars and plague. And, I mean, we're surrounded by that in our culture every single day throughout the day.
You know, the thing is, the good thing about that is it also makes you highly competitive, and it is a competitive spirit that helped man go to the moon. It is a competitive spirit that created the internet. It is a competitive spirit that created the smartphones. So that competition comes with its own fear of mortality, that everything will come to an end one day. So there are two sides to the coin. I think every civilization, you know, the belief that there is only one life and the world is going to come to an end, you know, in my lifetime, makes me anxious and work hard to find solutions. It has its own place, its own value, and the culture which believes there are many lives and don't worry too much and you know, yes, you can solve the problems, and if you don't solve the problem, somebody else will solve the problem. And I think that also has its place in society. I think the universe is infinite enough for all stories and all assumptions.
And that's what I love about these conversations. It just, there's such a, you're so enriched when you have conversations with other people, other cultures, other ways of looking at things. And, you know, we all learn and we can take away bits of whatever is relevant for us and help us to evolve and grow and learn.
Yes. I think that's what the whole point is, to see the other. That's why I keep saying the other matters. Because I may be a singular entity, but the other is an infinite entity. You know, you can have conversations with infinite other people and therefore be enriched infinite number of times. If only we step out and say hello to the other. I think that's important.
Yes, that's so important. And that's why I love this radio show, and I love having conversations with people from all over the world, because I get enriched. It opens me, expands my perception of who we are, and I'm sure you know, my listeners get the same value. So it's all about having conversations, isn't it? And being open to receive, you know, and
Absolutely.
Learn. Well, this has been such a wonderful conversation. I've so appreciated your time, your wisdom. You know, you've written 30 books. I just want to ask you something. Before we go, is there one book of yours that you think would be of interest or value to us here in America that we could learn from?
Well, my new book, My Gita, which helps. My Gita is about Indian philosophy. It sort of explains Indian philosophy very explicitly. It's available on, I think, Amazon.com. It's accessible. I think that would be a book if you're interested in philosophy, and if you want just storytelling, I think there are lots of books on Amazon.com. Just search for my name, David.com. And I don't know if some of the books are available in America, so that I'm not 100% sure. But my blog is there, David.com. Lots of essays to read, and I think that's a good starting point.
And the website is devdutt,
devdutt.com,
correct?
Yes.
Good.
And I think that's a good place to start. Or follow me on Twitter, Dave the Myth.
Wonderful. Well, thank you so much coming all the way from Mumbai. Have a great evening. It's been such a pleasure talking with you today. Thank you, Devdutt.
Thank you. Thank you so much.
And to all of you listening, thank you for joining me again today for another conversation. This is Dr. Cheryl Selman. You've been listening to What Women Must Know. My guest today from Mumbai was Devdutt Patnaik. And thank you all. Remember, always honor the wisdom of your feminine self. Bye for now.